Welcome to the MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me, as per usual, is James. Check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We most recently talked about Borat, and we somehow made it through the entire podcast without doing a single Borat impression. So I feel like, if nothing else, we deserve some sort of award for that.
So this one's going to be full of
Just so many Borat as Marion Crane impressions. Also, you can read something that I wrote last week about Adele, Justin Bieber, and a little bit about Shia LaBeouf, and all of their Novembers. Follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffinmen, and that's about it.
Welcome to the MacGuffinmen. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yep.
It's finally here. Time for our blind Star Wars predictions podcast.
Stop.
Han Solo's going to die.
Stop. No, we are doing a movie that I am... Actually, here's my prediction. A movie you like more than you will like Star Wars The Force Awakens.
Yeah, I think that's likely. I don't want to rule out anything yet, but I feel like... Hitchcock is a better director than J.J. Abrams. Not to say I don't like J.J. Abrams. And Psycho is one of his better movies. So I feel like the deck is stacked against you, J.J.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Going up against a film known as one of the greatest ever made.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But this one's going to definitely be the highest grosser of all time, you know? So it's got that. I tend to love movies that make bank. Avatar, yeah. Titanic.
Boffo box office.
The Avengers 2. Anyways, continue.
Yeah, we're talking about Psycho today. Yes, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. Based on a novel written by Robert Bloch.
Yep.
And so, I mean, we've kind of tipped our hand a bit, but it is a very, very, very well-regarded movie. I mean, Hitchcock's known as one of the greatest directors. I mean, this is known as one of his greatest movies. And I feel like it's sticking around better than some of his other ones. Like, I feel North by Northwest is kind of fading from people's memories a bit.
Yes, and, I would agree.
That was one of the ones people really used to like a lot. And I think Rear Window and Vertigo are still around. But I think Psycho is the iconic Hitchcock for most people, right?
Yeah, for sure. And Vertigo and Rear Window, I mean, specifically Vertigo, is mostly sticking around with people like us, like the nerdier types, you know? And Rear Window is a bit in the middle. But the casual film goer 100% knows Psycho, you know? It doesn't matter, like... If you've seen five movies, you know something about Psycho, probably.
Yeah, and, you know, it got that notoriety by being a successful movie. It kind of came out to mixed reviews initially. And, you know, I think just to frame its release, I think it's important to realize what a celebrity Hitchcock was at the time.
Yeah, for sure.
And, I mean, we know, even average kind of moviegoers know people's name, like... Spielberg and Christopher Nolan, Martin Scorsese and stuff, but Hitchcock was such a public figure, and he had, you know, a weekly TV show around this point, and
had an infamous silhouette.
Yeah, exactly. There's just so many things people knew about him, and that stuck around. But I think, you know, especially in an age before all the, you know, communication technology we have now and the big huge marketing machines for movies, I think it's just important to realize just that he was such a celebrity and not just someone who made movies, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And that's part of, you know, the success of this movie as well. Is it was a Hitchcock movie when Hitchcock was, you know, already such a huge deal.
Yeah, for sure. And I think very much plays on Hitchcock, what Hitchcock thinks an audience expects of a movie, and also what Hitchcock thinks an audience expects out of his movies, you know, because everybody seeing this movie knows it's a Hitchcock movie as well, you know, so they go in with certain expectations.
Yeah, absolutely. And this one, I mean, it's funny listening to the production story behind this movie, because, you know, he was such a such a celebrity and had a, you know, a pretty good track record up until this point, had been making movies for a long time. Mm-hmm. But the studio wasn't nuts about this project, right?
Yeah. And he was, which is even more bizarre because, I mean, he was following North by Northwest, right? Which I believe was a big hit. The movie before it was probably Vertigo, which was not. But, you know, I mean, by 1960, you'd think Hitchcock had enough clout to sort of make happen whatever he needed to make happen. Especially, I mean, this movie ended up being a very small budget movie, but even at a medium budget, you'd think Hitchcock could do whatever he wanted. You know, like if you know, somebody like Christopher Nolan wanted to make a $35 million movie tomorrow, he would be able to do it. You know, and it's surprising that that Hitchcock wasn't able to do that with this movie, you know?
Yeah, and he had to do it, you know, with his television crew. As we said, he had that weekly show. He was a TV crew instead of a film crew, which, you know, was just a lot different. And this is when TV was kind of, you know, very much second rung. And the idea of, you know, using a TV crew and using a small budget, this seems like kind of the modern equivalent of like going through Kickstarter instead of, you know, like, doesn't that seem like a good comparison though?
It does. Yeah. And I find it especially funny that he uses a TV crew because, I mean, this is the first time I've watched this movie in close to 10 years. And it felt so small, like the movie feels so small. And I was thinking about the time, and 1960 is when movie studios are still pretty terrified of losing their entire audiences to TV, right? So they start introducing, you know, widescreen CinemaScope and all that stuff. Like it's the time of, well, when Quentin Tarantino puts out The Hateful Eight in 70mm, he's like hearkening back to that specific time, you know?
Yeah, making those big spectacles.
Yeah, exactly.
Utilizing what a big screen can do compared to a little box in your living room.
Exactly. Going to see Ben-Hur in a screen wider than you could fathom, you know? And that Hitchcock, you know, specifically with a television crew, and this movie is very small, physically, and just the way that it's shot, and that it's in black and white, which is again something that you could get at home. I think I found that very interesting watching it through, that it's kind of like, movie studios are afraid of losing people to these things and also don't want Hitchcock to make this movie. And then Hitchcock just makes a movie out of all the things that they're afraid of. And it's a huge hit, you know, like it's just, I think that both speaks to Hitchcock's skill and his name's ability to draw people in as well.
Yeah. And I mean, to your point, I mean, this is 1960. It's not as though black and white was such a long time ago, but as you said, it was, you don't want to be caught doing the old thing anymore. You don't want to be caught making silent movies when, you know, the new thing has really taken off with audio. So yeah, mm-hmm. to make the conscious choice of just making this in black and white when, you know, that the technology was certainly available to do a color film, is a deliberate choice.
Yeah. And I mean, it's gorgeous black and white though. And you know, it's not like this movie looks ragtag by any means. I mean, it's Psycho. So we're watching one of the best film transfers that's ever been done for preservation purposes, you know, but,
yeah. Can you talk more about that? Because I was reading about, I've just been learning more about film recently, kind of with the Hateful Eight and, you know, we've watched some older movies lately. And someone's saying just the amount of resolution you can get in black and white is just incredible if that's what you choose to do. But did you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, sure. Well, I find like, well, with black and white film, I will say I know less about that than film in general. But the thing that is really helpful with black and white is when you want something to be stark, it's so stark. And when there's like a little line of light hitting Norman Bates's jawline, you know, in an otherwise dark room, it just really pops out, since you only have two options of colors, right? Yeah. Well, not even colors, they're tints. The things that do shine really, really well. And the thing that I love most about black and white cinematography is the blacks. When you want something to totally disappear, even if it's just light falling off of Arbogast's face in a couple shots, you know, it's really beautiful. Or when Norman is looking through the peephole, that's a really, really beautiful shot that is beautiful specifically because of how it's done in black and white. Film in general, I mean, my quick hot take on film is that the average digital projection of a movie is better than the average film projection, but the best film projection is of a much higher quality than the best digital projection, simply because with digital you have pixels, and it drives me crazy because I also like to sit close to the screen when I'm at a movie, and when you go to a movie, if you look for pixels, you can see them, and that drives me crazy. Whereas
if you're not seeing the Adam Sandler film pixels,
yeah, even then, even not that. Although weirdly, The Kingsway in Etobicoke was playing pixels on 35mm earlier this summer, which I found very, very charming. Almost made me want to go see it. But what you see on film, like, there aren't pixels because it's like a physical thing. There's no end to the lines, you know, and it's just, it gives it more, it just looks better. And film, since there is actually a physical thing there, it just sort of has this more girth to it. But I mean, that doesn't really apply to Psycho any more than it does to any other movie that came out in 1960 that was projected on film, you know? Yeah. But yeah, in general, the best use of film is better than the best use of digital.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
And well, this is coming from David Fincher's biggest fan too. So.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about the movie then. It seems appropriate.
yeah, for sure. Sorry, the call just came through on my computer somehow. I don't know what's happening. again, film is better than digital. It's less confusing. The movie. It's quite a good film.
Yeah, okay. And you saw this in film class, I guess, 10 years ago, and then haven't watched it since?
Yes, Contemporary American Cinema class is the last time I saw it. Shout out to Barbara Bruce.
obviously listening
obviously not embarrassed at what her student has done with her teachings.
What is it that makes it such a good movie then?
I mean, specifically it's the shower scene, you know, and that scene is so good, and on its own it's so good, and I think the way that the movie builds to it is really great because, you know, Hitchcock is he's a master stylist. I mean, Vertigo comes out before this and is such a wonderful stylish movie. And in Psycho, especially the first half of the movie, it's like Hitchcock decided to rein in his own skills, you know, and the movie kind of lulls you into this sort of comfortable space. Like, there aren't really very many creative framing choices done in the first little bit of the movie. And then after Marion dies, you start to get more of that, like more creative stuff, you know, like the shot from above in the staircase, that type of stuff. And
yeah. And it's as though we've kind of turned a corner on the movie. Like, everything is so, you know, I feel like so much of it is so natural at the beginning. I mean, filmmaking wise. And as you said, it's not nearly as stylistic, and, you know, then we have this big plot point, the murder, and then, you know, then you're really hooked in, and then we kind of get these more stylish things.
Yeah, for sure. And and I think that I mean, I don't think I ever saw this movie without knowing that the shower scene was coming, but this movie is pretty notorious for having surprised the shit out of people when Marion dies. And I think part of Hitchcock structuring the movie that way, I should point out the very intro to the movie, the shots of Phoenix as we're setting up, that's very stylish. But pretty much once you get into the hotel room, it is no longer. Then we're into the very, you know, standard filmmaking sort of realm. And then it's just to sort of make the audience feel comfortable. It's like you're riding along with this Marion Crane character, and we're not going to throw anything out there that's going to make you think that anything too dramatic is going to happen anytime soon. And then, you know, probably the most dramatic thing that could happen to you happens to Marion. She gets murdered. And I think the way the movie really kind of sets itself up with not really hurrying through the plot, and also not doing anything to make us too engaged until the most engaging scene of the movie, I think is it's really impressive, and I think shows a certain skill level that you have to be, like, of the, you know, of a certain talent to have, you know, to be so talented that you know that you can hold back and still keep people interested.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think it's 47 minutes in is when we get that scene. Yeah. I mean, there's a bit of uneasiness, you know, because she's committed this crime and, you know, she's driving and she's hearing all these people, you know, what she's guessing people are probably saying about her. And, you know, she's getting followed by that cop and the very sketchy car sale.
Yeah. And the music is not relaxing.
Yeah, there's uneasiness to it. I mean, it engages you in that way, but there's not even a jump scare of anything.
Yeah.
You know, to make you, you know, really kind of on the edge of your seat and really, really nervous. There's just kind of this unpleasant, impending something bad is going to happen, but you feel as though she's just, you know, get caught. It's nothing, you know, murderous or really, really awful comes to mind. And then, as you said, it very quickly does. And things go very, very dark very quickly. But, I mean, yeah, just the fact that it's almost an hour of this without really freaking you out, I think, yeah, it shows a patience and a confidence in your filmmaking from Hitchcock's part.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. There was something that I did like visually, even before that shower scene. I think we'll get back to the shower scene because it is, you know, the iconic scene, and
I have things to say.
And I imagine you would. I think we both will. But after she's stolen the money and she's changing in her room, you know, still in Phoenix, she's got her closet open and you can see, you know, just some more of her clothes hanging up on the rod there. I really liked this the first time I noticed it, but her open closet door cuts the frame right down the middle. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of this moment where there is such a clear right and wrong thing to do. You know, she could it's really not as though she's gone too far with this. Like she's kind of decided to take the money, but you feel like she could make an excuse at this point or deposit the money Monday morning and, you know, say she was feeling sick and she went right home. And, you know, it really doesn't feel like she's past the point of no return here. And there's just no moral question about what she's done.
Yeah.
You know, she's just been trusted with money and she's going to, you know, take advantage of that. And, you know, $40,000 is enough to buy a house. You know what I mean? If we adjust for inflation, it's not a small amount of money by any means. It's enough for her to think she can start a whole new life with it.
Yeah.
But that was just something I really enjoyed visually. And as you said, there's not these big kind of stylish moments, but there's still some very thoughtful cinematography and thoughtful visual choices that I enjoy.
Oh yeah, for sure. And one thing that is, you know, still nothing too stylish, but certainly helps move things along is when Marion and Norman are talking in the parlor, not too long before Marion's going to be murdered. Their conversation that they're having is there aren't a lot of changes in the shot. It's kind of just like shot of Marion, shot of Norman, shot of Marion, shot of Norman. And then the shot changes once Marion mentions Norman's mother. And then it changes again upon the mention of the madhouse. So as things are changing in between these characters, the shots are changing. So it's not like Hitchcock was just like, put a tripod on, put the camera on the tripod, roll the mag and we'll just shoot, you know?
Yeah.
There's still thought put into it, but it's all very, very, very deliberate. And he's really trying to hide it from you, you know? And I also find those driving sequences of Marion pretty hypnotic as well. I think they're really well done, and you know, not that far away from what Hitchcock did in Vertigo. But like the thing that is much different in Vertigo is that Jimmy Stewart's head is like moving, and there's colors going on behind him, and you know, he doesn't have a body in a lot of those shots, you know. So so it's a really toned down version of the same things that I liked about those shots in Vertigo, which is another movie I love, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so the shower scene.
Shower scene.
I mean, it's tough to watch movies that are so so iconic and so well known, as you said, you know, if you've seen five movies, you've picked up something about Psycho. Mm-hmm. I saw this movie when I was pretty young, and then you know, saw it again around when you had seen it the first time. And I've seen it a few times. And yeah, I mean, it's just all over popular culture. So it is really hard to distance yourself. I mean, there's a very big twist in this movie. And even just that shower scene, you know, since you see her going to the shower, you know exactly what's going to happen just because of how popular, you know, this scene has become. But I think it is still such a remarkably engaging and horrifying scene when you consider that you know it's going to happen. You know so much about it. Often when a scene gets spoofed a lot, it kind of bleeds into the original. Pardon the pun. And kind of makes it hard to just enjoy on its own. But I still find this one is so immediate and so so effective still.
Yeah, for sure. And it's kind of expressionistic as well. Like, it's not your standard murder scene, you know, even though this ended up setting the table for future murder scenes to come, you know.
In the slasher genre, I mean, this is a lot more, you know, pensive than a slasher that we think of now, but definitely has a lot to do with getting that ball rolling.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, the things that I'm referring to are, you know, you see shots of these details that are, you know, like, they're just things that are there, but it also sort of helps to augment the scene, like the shower head shot at the beginning and then again at the end. The framing when we see the shadow of Norma Bates coming to attack Marion, and also the separation in the frame when we see these cuts to the knife and to Marion reacting to the knife. They're just not together in the same frame all that frequently, and it's just this really, it's jarring because it doesn't quite, you know, it's a bunch of pieces that add up to a whole, and all of those pieces are done so well. And you're right, it really, really makes the scene really incredible.
Yeah, and I like the violins, the score is so essential there. Bernard Herrmann, the guy doing the music. And it's my understanding that Hitchcock really didn't want to have any music in that scene at all. And, you know, just playing it very naturalistically would be the most frightening thing to do. And there's kind of the story that he, you know, doubled Bernard Herrmann's pay just because of how effective this was. And yeah, I mean, it's cut together amazingly, very fast editing for the time, especially very unique and just really powerful. Yeah, the music is so much of it, but the way it's cut together is so much of it as well. It's just so much stuff coming together very nicely. And just the fact that the knife and the body are so rarely even in the same frame, and that you really get this, you know, really grotesque sense of the stabbing happening when you see really none of it, and you don't really see the wounds, you don't see you know, her mutilated body that you imagine would be the case. You just see, you know, her eye. You see her in a very, you know, odd, beyond uncomfortable position because she's dead. They dance around it so much, but you just get the sense that you've seen something so awful and violent. And it is a very awful and violent act, but it's not filmed in a way that you get it really head on. It's just, it's done in a very, you know, as you said, expressionistic, very abstract way, but the effect of it is very, you know, very violent and very jarring.
Yeah, and it, the thing that I think really elevates the scene to me is it feels like such a lonely scene, you know, and like Marion is so alone. I mean, there's nobody there to help her. She's obviously alone in that sense, but also just, I mentioned that showerhead shot when they cut to that at the end of the scene again, after Marion is dead, and it's just doing the exact same thing. It's like the world continues on without you, no matter what, you know, like it doesn't pause for you in any capacity. And, you know,
even if this super horrible, very, you know, beyond emotional, beyond like just the worst, you know, thing that could happen to you. Mm-hmm. And yeah, no difference in the shower head. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And she just, like, her blood just goes down the drain, and it's the world's just done with her. Her time is up, you know? And then we cut to her eye and zoom out from her corpse. And the water, the sound of the water, I find so, so important as well, because again, further augmenting the fact that these things continue on without you, you know? And I just think that's so, it's so great. It elevates the scene. It elevates the movie. The fact that we immediately go into a pretty long scene of cleaning up the body, disposing of what you leave behind, basically, I think is, I don't know. It's just, it makes the whole, the scene and the ideas behind the scene, I think it makes it all much sadder, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, that's a theme that we have throughout the movie is, you know, things change out of your control and you're kind of left behind.
Yeah.
You know, we have it with Norman, Norman's mother, you know, dying and him, what he has to do mentally to deal with that, mm-hmm. you know, to make that seem as though it's not the case anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And just the idea of his motel being so out of business, you know, they just moved the highway and now no one comes around anymore. And
yeah, exactly.
That's it. And yeah, and I think another thing about that is the hint that Sam
yes
gets is the curtain, the shower curtain being gone. And you know, it's this idea of it's not a spot of blood that's found, it's something that's missing, and just you know, something's gone away, and there's this space that is left over, and he pieces it together through that. But it's just another example of something leaving and having this effect, and you know, that kind of getting the ball rolling on attempting to solve this murder, at least.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Anything else about the shower scene?
I don't know. It's just, I watched it like five times. Like I just think it's so good. And for all we said about this movie being kind of certainly in comparison to a lot of other Hitchcock movies, not being that stylish. I think it's
so much style so fast when it does.
Exactly.
Begin, right.
Yeah. And I don't know. I wish I could have seen this movie in 1960, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, do you want to talk about, you know, kind of what a big change this was for the time? And I mean, we talked about it kind of kickstarting the, slasher genre.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a very shocking movie for the time.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to look at some of the elements of what made that the case?
Well, they showed a toilet.
Yeah.
Which is so funny to me.
Like, it seems so quaint now.
Yeah. It's
so,
like, oh, I do declare there's a toilet in the scene.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it's just so bizarre. Weirdly, that's the one I'm remembering. That's the one that I assume it's extremely violent, that sequence for a movie of the time, right?
Yeah, well, but that's, you know, something we talked about. It's, you don't see that much violence.
Mm-hmm.
You see
yeah.
a dead body, you see blood going down the drain. You know, it's quite clear what's happened, but yeah, the level of violence, yeah, I was definitely part of it. And kind of the mixing of sexuality and violence is, I think, something that was a big problem.
Yeah.
You know, him watching her change.
Mm-hmm. I think it was odd that she was in a bra as well, or very uncommon.
Yeah, that was a big deal. And, you know, just seeing someone naked being murdered, you mm-hmm. know, it's another combination of sex and violence. Yeah, and it's just really interesting to me that just the juxtaposition of the lack of real violence depicted versus what you take away from it. It's interesting to me that it was, you know, an artistic, stylistic choice that made this, that set such a precedent, I think, is remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it was just a long, you know, medium shot of someone being stabbed and it being very straightforward like that, to me, that seems like the more obvious candidate for a really shocking moment. But this one, you know, I think it just speaks to the power of cinema and an art form where you can combine sound and visuals and story.
Yeah, yeah.
In the way that you can in film. I think that's what's so remarkable about it, is that it was achieved these you know, interesting artistic cinematic choices.
Yeah.
It's what's fascinating to me.
Yeah, for sure. It always, you know, always, you know, you don't always have to show everything to get the best reaction out of people. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I and
listen up, Eli Roth.
Yeah, yes, and I think the main star being killed off, you know, essentially halfway through this movie, I think, was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, for sure.
In my understanding, is that that's not something that hadn't been done before, but you know, a big movie star, one that it seems like will be your protagonist for the entire film, you know, gets murdered and you never see her again. And I think that's something interesting. And because of the twist, because of the ending that, you know, Miss Bates has been dead this entire time, there was the, you know, unique marketing campaign that you hear about where Hitchcock demanded that no theaters let people in after the movie had started.
Yeah.
And I think that goes, you know, hand in hand with what we talked about of Hitchcock being a celebrity, kind of having that nature about him, being able to pull that off. You know, that story doesn't even get traction if this isn't a big, very famous director, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And not only would it not get traction, I think it just wouldn't get listened to. So I think it's just a very, you know, unique ad campaign helps out. And it was just one other thing that set this movie apart. You know, it was black and white in the 60s. It was, you know, these weird rules of how you have to watch this movie, the death of our lead partway through, this really, you know, interesting artistic shower scene that we've talked about. It is just a combination of all these things that makes it, you know, such an outlier in the best way possible.
Yeah, for sure. And though you talked about the advertising and the fact that the trailer, you know, I mean, if we were to go back to 1960 and watch a boatload of trailers, we'd see some weird stuff for sure. But the trailer is Alfred Hitchcock giving like a mini tour of the Bates Motel, right?
Yeah.
And that I'm certain is weird, even though trailers in the 1960s were probably less cookie cutter than they are now, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that furthers all of your points, you know, that Hitchcock was able to say, you can't come in past, you know, second one, you know, and also I'm going to promote this movie by just showing you a set and talking, you know, and that's it.
Yeah. It's such a weird, it just seems like putting so much distance between the audience and to the film, you know, to look at it as such a film and not as a story, I think is such an odd choice that seems to have paid off.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the twist a little bit. You know, we mentioned that in the marketing campaign. I imagine you probably knew the twist the first time you saw it.
Yes. I mean, I think the list of things I knew about this movie before seeing it is much longer than the list of things I did not know about this movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about how they, you know, achieve that, how they set up this character as a real character and not just another part of Norman's personality.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just off-screen conversations basically, right? And he mentions her pretty frequently.
Yeah.
In conversations with other people on screen. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, we see her outline you know, later on we see her carried to the basement and you know, really early on, we just have that argument that they have, you know, Marion overhears Norman and his mother having this argument about guests and eating in the house and all this kind of thing. You know, it just builds up that character and it gives you the understanding of why you haven't seen her yet.
Yeah.
You know, but, and it also, you know, anything that you're told about, but told that you can't see yet just builds your interest, of who this person could be. What do they look like? How did they end up like this? What are they going to do next? And, you know, all of that really just, you know, escalates your feelings about this person and gets you more and more interested. And, you know, I just feel that you're so locked into this movie and this person's identity that by the time you understand, you know, the true nature of who she is and whether or not she's actually alive.
Yeah.
You know, it's so late in the movie and there's been so much build up to it.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, I suppose I didn't even think about that all that much again, because I just, you know, I know so much about this movie that it's kind of all these little weird technical details that are the only things that can be new to me, you know? So I honestly didn't even think about that. And yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Oh, and I actually, on that note, I think one of the things that I think was shocking at the time was seeing her body the way that it is, and seeing a skeleton on its own, it's not that creepy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just, you know, there's something so clinical and kind of medical about, you know, just a skeleton, but seeing one dressed up, you know, in a wig and clothes and things like that, that's unsettling in a different way, much more so to me. And obviously, you know, that goes with the whole narrative of him, you know, treating her like a still living person. This idea that he's had this corpse in his house for, you know, a very long time and kind of living two lives with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it also just the visual of seeing something like that, I think, was particularly unsettling then as well.
Yeah, for sure. And the way that there's a, you know, loose light bulb hanging in the middle of the room that Marion's sister accidentally knocks out of fear, and just the way that they then use that to light the rest of the scene. You know, it's basically like a slowly moving strobe, you know, that continually changes the light throughout all of these shots of the skeleton, and then also of Norman being grabbed by Sam, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that whole lighting design is really smart too.
Yeah. No, that's good. And it's just, yeah, it just makes that seem so dynamic in a way that it wouldn't, I think, being lit pretty much any other way.
Yeah. Here's how influential Psycho is, and like, you know, quietly even. I shot a music video like 2 months ago, and we just did the light swinging thing just because I thought it would add visual interest, and it did. And of course, it was like it was a Psycho thing that had just been stuck in my head for years. And Hitchcock still, you know, like 50 years later has still affected minds, you know?
Yeah. Is there anything that doesn't work for you anymore? Anything that does look hokey or anything?
I don't know about hokey, but, you know, I mean, there's just some things, I don't know what it is. I can't think of anything, actually.
Arbogast falling down the stairs?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's just of the time, you know, those things never really.
That's what I mean.
Okay. Yeah. Those things just don't really jump out at me, I guess, because, I tend to be very forgiving of a time period that a movie exists within, like, and then I'm very impressed when it looks more modern than it is, but I'm always pretty forgiving with the things that look of the time, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
and
the shot leading into the Arbogast falling is so good.
The shot
from above where Norma comes out of the bedroom and stabs him. You know, and it's another like reveal shot that isn't the person just popping up in the frame, right? It's like we have this framing and we see this person enter the frame in a not all that quick sort of way, you know? And that's, I enjoy that as opposed to, you know, the camera sort of panning. Oh God, it's Norma, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a very interesting shot. And yeah, I mean, the fact that you even see her nose kind of popping out and you've seen her wig or, I mean, her hair in the shower scene, it really kind of fleshes out this character as, you know, someone who is an individual. And yeah, I think that's done really well.
Oh, we didn't talk about the way that Norma's lit in the shower scene, because that's amazing. The way that she is just basically a silhouette, despite the room being so... so bright, you know, it's like it's a small bathroom, which is
mostly
just,
white. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Which is pretty much always a bright place to be, you know, and she somehow, like that was one of the things that I was trying to figure out watching it was just how they could make her appear so dark without, as you said, there's so much white as a natural bounce. So everything surrounding it is just bouncing light, and then she still looks like this threatening silhouette of like death personified, you know, and coming to get Marion, you know, like when you least expect it. And that's one of, I think, really one of the best things about that sequence too, you know.
Yeah, you can pick out individual strands in her hair, but you can't see her face, even though it's right on, it's just directly shooting right into the face.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And then showers were ruined the way Jaws ruined the ocean.
I don't miss the ocean, though. I really wish I could bathe, though.
Yeah, true. I would say that the, like, it's, you know, as we talked about, it kind of did get the ball rolling on slasher. But there's not that many deaths. It's not that violent of a movie. It's, you know, kind of almost barely not even a horror. It seems more thriller, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
One of my favorite film terms.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I forgot. Just don't call it dark or gritty and we're good.
Yeah. I distinctly remember the first time seeing this that I'm not someone who talks during or to movies that often.
Yeah.
But Marion's sister going downstairs, I think, is such an intense moment. You know, she goes into the basement. She kind of sees a chance to get out. But, you know, she seems kind of willed by the audience's curiosity of what Miss Bates could possibly look like that she's forced into the basement.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah. Why does Marion steal the money?
I don't know, because I was trying to think about that. Is it to, like, I was thinking, is it to help pay off Sam's debts? Like, is she going to get in contact with Sam and then they run away together? Or, because I figured that was an explanation that I just missed.
Yeah, that seems, I mean, the whole intro of them, you know, I guess, having had fooled around in that room and are now just talking and putting their clothes back on so she can go to work. You know, he talks how he lives in the back of a hardware store and he's got all these debts and things like that. The narrative seems to paint that picture pretty clearly, that she's going to have enough money that she and Sam are going to start a new life together.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't know if you had another take on that. I don't really either. It's just this movie is about, you know, at the beginning about adultery, about Norman living alone, about, you know, kind of lying to himself. You know, her Marion's boss seems like, you know, an asshole. The guy who gives her the money to deposit seems to have more money than he knows what to do with. You know, he doesn't seem like a bad guy, but it seems like he wouldn't miss this much money, even though it is a large amount of money.
Mm-hmm. That guy's very funny, by the way.
Yeah,
I assume you and I are on the same page.
Oh, there. Yeah, 100%. And I like how much her boss clearly doesn't care for him, but wants the deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, Norman doesn't know how to use an umbrella. I don't know if you caught that, too. He's
I don't
running
think
into the
I
rain
did.
With it at his side. It's odd. But anyway, I just didn't know if you...
Oh, his hips move very oddly when he walks upstairs as well, now that we're pointing out little things about people.
Because he's a bird. No, I just didn't know if... And I don't have a take on it, but there's just kind of these ideas of loneliness throughout this movie.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you said it in the shower scene. You know, the water keeps running and... Yeah, there's kind of this mundane thing of, you know, just taking a shower and then this insane, awful, stylistic, loud, you know, jumpy moment of her being murdered and then, you know, back to that mundane thing. Like all these massive, incredibly powerful things in your life are, you know, incredibly powerful to you and no one else gives a shit. I just didn't know if you kind of had any feeling about that, if that ties into... you know, her motivation in stealing this money and what sets this movie in motion.
Well, actually, like, I like, because I mean, I thought about it a lot. I like the idea of her just running away with the money by herself. I like what that, you know, if that was her idea, and that's what the movie wants us to think, then I like that version of the movie better than her running away and then calling Sam so that they can run away together. Because I think there's such a big thread running through this movie of, you know, loneliness. And also you can never really know somebody, you know, like I think that really certainly plays into it. And also the idea that, logic can't explain away everything, you know, like there's no intelligent thought behind what Marion's doing. She's just running away with this money and Sam would never expect her to, you know, like less than 3 hours earlier, they were talking about, you know, having an honest relationship with each other, you know? And then she just disappears with $40,000 of, I mean, not yet her boss's money, but on its way to being her boss.
Rightfully.
Money.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, I like the idea of this movie being about how you can never truly know a person, you know, because I think that further augments the loneliness, but also, you know, adds it or turns it over to Sam and Marion's sister, whose name I keep forgetting.
Lila?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And especially like Lila, like probably one of the people that knows Marion the best in the world. It's like even she wouldn't understand what is happening here, you know?
Yeah.
And I like that, you know, because it's a little dark and weird, especially for a movie as big as this one.
Yeah, and I mean, the reason she's able to do this, Marion, is because they trust her, you know.
Yeah.
Go deposit this money. Okay, well, I'm not going to come back today because I have a headache, you know, and yeah, that's fine, whatever. You know, they trust her so much at this point. And what you said about not being able to know anybody, I mean, you literally can't know Miss Bates anymore. Like it's not even a person. And this is, as you said, this is a small movie. There's six characters, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a couple fringe characters, but really anybody worth knowing. It's a pretty short list. Mm-hmm. And the fact that one of them's, you know, been dead for the entirety of this film, I think, you know, speaks to that point. And the lack of logic, I think, is something I like it in a lot. And
yeah,
it's, you know, it's a mystery movie in a way. You know, we have a lot of people trying to figure something out. What happened to the money or what happened to Marion? And, you know, those two are obviously linked together. But what I love about this is the people who are trying to figure this out, you know, they're all wrong. Pretty much everyone's wrong. But what's unique about it is that so many people are wrong in different ways. You know, it's not like there's this one red herring that's throwing everybody off. There's all these pieces of information throughout the movie that people don't have a correct understanding of. And they all, you know, function in different ways. Like Sam and Lila think Arbogast is a crook. You know, he thinks he's found the money and, you know, just pretending he hasn't. Different characters think Norman knows about the money, which is incorrect. Mm-hmm. Obviously the big one of Miss Bates being a still living person. There's all these misconceptions and misunderstandings and everyone's trying to figure something out or accomplish something. And they're all, so many of them are incorrect or going about it in different, but equally incorrect ways. And I think that's fascinating. I think this idea of not knowing anybody and being this confused, you know, she doesn't know where she's going. She doesn't really seem to have a plan for this money, like a huge one. Norman doesn't know about the money, which is why so many other people are interested in Marion in the first place. Like there's just all these different moving factors and people have all these different motivations and levels of understanding and are so often mistaken that, you know, I think that really speaks to, you know, what you said earlier about not having to, you know, not really being able to ever know anybody or really get a good grip of what's happening and just how one person's place in the world can kind of come and go and that there's everyone else has one and, you know, everyone has their own, you know, train, their own narrative, their own process and they're very rarely the same thing.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly.
Anything else about Psycho? I mean, there's so much. It's,
yeah,
there's so much reading you can do about this movie. So if anyone wants to know more, there's billions and billions of articles. Yeah, about it.
It's a little thing called the internet that you can peruse.
But the production of it, so storied, yeah. The reception of it, so interesting, the impact of it.
I didn't read this anytime recently, and I'm so confident that I know that the stabbing sound came from somebody stabbing a cantaloupe, you know, yeah. Like, and yeah. Is that true? Am I right?
Yep.
Okay. I cannot imagine when I learned that fact, but it's something that is in my head as a thing that I know about Psycho, you know, just because of what you're describing, you know?
Yeah. Do you see any value in a shot for shot remake of a movie?
I mean, I watched it, so I must have. Just curiosity, I guess. I don't know. It just...
I mean, that's the reason to watch it, but why make it?
I have no idea. It didn't make sense at the time, and it still doesn't make sense.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess the logical...
And we're talking about Gus Van Sant's 1998 shot-for-shot remake.
Yeah, Vince Vaughn.
Yeah, exactly.
And Mesh.
and Gus Van Sant, who I do not like on the best of days.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I've seen this movie. I saw it a long time ago, but my understanding is that it's almost the exact same. It's in color. There's a bit more violence and nudity and masturbation, but, you know, shot for shot remake for the most part, like trying to make the exact same movie, you know, slightly updated with, you know, the amounts of money are different and the foods mentioned are different because they've gone out of style. But I didn't think that you would love the 1998 version, but I just didn't know if you had any opinion on them existing.
No, it's just it's crazy that it got greenlit. It's crazy that Psycho, the Alfred Hitchcock movie, had trouble getting made, and then a shot-for-shot remake of it was made in 1998. And everybody's like, "Yeah, that's a thing we can do." You know, like it's just so illogical. Maybe it's
Sorry. What I was going to say, the easy answer is people don't want to watch black and white movies anymore. Young people in 1998 don't want to watch a black and white movie, right? So you make it in color. And it's such a good movie that you just make it again. And it should be really good. Like, it's weird to me to see a one-star review of a shot-for-shot remake of a, you know, a critically understood, almost perfect film.
Yeah.
I just don't understand how it could be that much different. I guess that's just people upset with the idea.
I think so. I think it's just the same people having an internal conversation that mirrors what we're doing right now. Like, just why? You know?
Yeah. It's just incredible to me to...
Home video exists, is in full swing by that point. You know, it's just watch Psycho or re-release Psycho. Yeah. That's probably what the critics were thinking. They're like, I wish I could see Psycho in a theater again. Oh, wait, I don't want it to be with Vince Vaughn, you know?
Yeah.
So... I do want to talk about the very last shot in, or not the very last shot, but one of the last shots in Psycho, where we kind of get
sick of the movie because it starts sucking at the end.
Well, I don't quite agree with you on that, but the shot of Norman alone in the room when the cop brings a blanket in for him, and we get this again. We get a pretty wide shot of Norman. He's framed to the left of the frame. And we slowly start zooming in on his face, and it ends up being yet another really good shot of a face by Hitchcock. I don't know if you've seen this video by Coconata. It's called Eyes of Hitchcock, but it's so worth checking out.
Anthony Perkins has a face, though.
Yeah, he does have a face. inarguable fact.
Eyes of Hitchcock.
Yeah, but no, doesn't matter. That's not the video I was talking about. Or sorry, not what I was trying to get at. But just the way that he's against a white wall, you know, and after we get past this window that has been in the shot, it's just Norman alone on a white background, and we get closer and closer to his face. And, you know, the ending resolution of the shot is just his face in the frame, which is something we've seen a lot throughout the movie, you know, and through other Hitchcock movies, but specifically this one. And we get a person that was alone in a white space, and we get a zoom into what they're left with. It's just them and their own thoughts. And we've talked about this movie being a movie that seems to be kind of about loneliness. And, you know, the ending of the movie is that when all is said and done, you are alone in a room with your own brain, and that's pretty much it. Everything else happens regardless of whether or not you're there. And it's just such a sort of dark movie, you know, yeah. And dark place to end on, or dark thought to end on. Obviously this is a very dark character, but you know, I think it's sort of implying that this is all of us. Like, when all of the action is done, we're alone with our own thoughts. You know, even if it's just the end of your day and you're about to go to bed and you're sitting on your bed and it's just you alone, you know, thinking about whatever you did. And I think that's a wonderful note to end on, you know, and I mean wonderful in a very specific sort of way. You know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Even, you know, most of us won't go through the things that Marion or Norman go through, you know, during the time depicted in this film. But yeah, I think, you know, that's just such a universal thing, you know, such a universal and timeless idea that, you know, you can, you can negotiate these things any way you want. You can act any way you want. You can, if your brain can't handle the thought of your mother being dead, you can dress like her and have conversations with your with yourself in order to keep them, to keep that mirage alive. But you can't keep it up forever. And all these kind of things we build up in ourselves and around us all go away eventually, and you can't possibly maintain on that track. And yeah, that's what you're left with. You're alone in a room, and your head is flashing into a skull because all that's left is death.
Somebody's clearly reading a Cormac McCarthy book right now. thank you for listening to the MacGuffin. Be sure to check back next week for our next episode about Star Wars The Force Awakens. But until then, we will now leave you alone in a room with your own thoughts.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.